many breaths of fresh air today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Syrian refugee spent the past 9 months in Malaysia, first stranded in an airport, then in detention. This week, he's starting a new life in Canada.
I can relax now, to be free and to just have some fresh air. Since yesterday, I did not sleep yet, and I just went outside like 10 times.
Also, a proposed rule change by the Trump administration has many immigrants confused. They're worried they'll risk their legal status if they use some public benefits. So many are doing without, just in case.
I fear that at some point they change something else and I will be deported. How can I be sure that it's not going to be a problem?
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for being here today. Criminals in the caravan. It's an allegation that President Trump hammered on for weeks leading up to this fall's midterms, that an untold number of criminals are lurking in the groups of Central American migrants traveling toward the U.S. border with Mexico. The president has given no evidence for his allegation. Now, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen is weighing in with some actual numbers.
The reality is that the majority of the caravan that we see is made up of single adult males or teenage males. In addition, we have identified over 500 criminals, to include known gang members, contained in the flow of the caravan.
That's Nielsen speaking at the border last week. She tweeted this week that the number is more than 600. This is a story we've been following closely here on The World, and we've been wondering, how does the White House know this number? I asked Nick Miroff, who's been following the story for The Washington Post.
This is a very contentious point, and a lot of the administration's critics are suspicious, maybe rightly so, of how this information is being used. Because when you press Homeland Security officials to tell you how they know the 600 or however many members of the caravan are criminals, they'll say, no, we can't say, it's law enforcement sensitive. What we can tell you is that they have information sharing programs that they don't want to publicly acknowledge with the Mexican government that involve gathering identification and biometric data on Central American migrants who come into contact with Mexican authorities.
So how is the U.S. government even collecting data on the migrants? Do we know that?
So here's how it would work. Let's say someone coming up through Mexico is invited to register with Mexican authorities to get a temporary transit visa, or they go through some kind of information processing encounter in Mexico. That information, in some cases, is shared with the United States, either forwarded directly by being entered into databases and technology that the United States has installed in Mexico, or through other forms of information sharing agreements.
And when we're talking biometric data, we're talking like eye scans or photographs? I mean, what are we talking about?
Typically fingerprints, but sometimes it can involve retinal scans and identification information and any tattoos.
And when we say criminal records, do we know how many of these 600 are violent offenders versus how many may be just guilty of trying to slip across the border at some point?
Right. Well, that's the thing that the DHS doesn't break down, you know, and I think really needs to be questioned, because a lot of those who have quote unquote criminal convictions are people whose main crime is illegal reentry. Now, that is a felony under federal law. But, you know, you can imagine these are people who had lived in the United States at one point, who probably were deported and are trying to get back, in some cases, to families that are already living here. So DHS, to this point, you know, when they say there are 600 criminals in the caravan, I think the real question needs to be, how many of those 600 are convicted of violent offenses?
So the Trump administration is not the first one to use this for migrants. Am I correct?
That's right. You know, these programs have been in the works for a long time. This is really like a kind of a post-September 11th initiative, as the United States wanted to get a better handle on people coming up through Mexico en route to the United States border. They have been attempting to work with Mexican authorities to install better technology, better screening, all of those kinds of things, particularly in southern Mexico.
I know this program has not been a secret, but Mexican authorities have kept it pretty quiet, haven't they?
That's right. There were always concerns in Mexico about what the Americans may be learning in Mexico or the information that they may be gathering up and what's done with that information. So given the privacy sensitivities of it, Mexican officials don't tend to talk about it publicly.
Do we know if the incoming Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is he going to support this program?
That's one of the big questions. Is he willing to kind of continue the same security partnership that has been developing with this type of biometric information sharing program, a big part of that?
And what are the biggest concerns about how Washington might use this data?
I don't know if there's a specific concern other than a sensitivity in Mexico to the idea that the United States government is penetrating its institutions or meddling in its affairs or learning too much about what's happening in its government. So I think it's not so much a specific issue as the concern that the United States is too influential in Mexico.
Nick Miroff with The Washington Post, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure, Marco.
For some immigrants already in the country, the Trump administration wants to make life a little more difficult. It's proposing rules to make it harder to get a visa or a green card for immigrants who might use public benefits, things like food stamps, health insurance, or low-income housing. The proposal is complicated, and it's causing confusion and fear among some immigrant families. We've got more from reporter Zadie Stavely.
Maria is from Mexico, lives in Sacramento, and has a green card. Her husband and two young daughters are U.S. citizens. The little one is just 3 months old. Maria coos at her in Spanish and English.
Big chicks. Yes, cute chicks. This is my chicks.
After giving birth, Maria had trouble breastfeeding. So Maria's pediatrician recommended formula and that Maria apply for WIC, shorthand for a federal program that helps low-income moms and kids with breastfeeding and healthy groceries. Maria knew WIC could help. She used it with her first daughter. But this time, Maria didn't seek out the help because she's afraid. She asked not to use her full name, fearing it could jeopardize her legal status.
I am afraid that I won't be able to stay in this country.
Maria already has a green card, and WIC isn't one of the benefits the Trump administration's proposal would limit. But the proposal has gone through several versions, enough for Maria to think it could risk her status here somehow. So Maria also canceled her older daughter's Medicaid. Now the kindergartner is uninsured.
I fear that at some point they change something else and I will be deported. How can I know the future, right? How can I be sure that it's not going to be a problem?
The government says the changes keep taxpayers from paying for some immigrants who use some public benefits, and that immigrants shouldn't panic and drop out of programs. Here's what U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Director Francis Cisna said recently.
There should not be a mad rush to unsubscribe from all benefits. That is unwarranted, I think. It's very clearly laid out what we're going to look at and what we're not going to look at.
Officials also say the changes would make it harder for people to get green cards if they're likely to use or have used certain benefits like Medicaid, food stamps, or public housing. Benefits used by children can't be counted against their parents. But earlier versions of the regulations said they would, and that's created fear.
We've heard that people have asked to return their WIC vouchers or return their breast pumps and just be sort of purged from the computer system entirely.
Sarah Diaz helps run a nonprofit that promotes the WIC program in California. She's heard a lot of stories like this lately. So have staff at other agencies that serve low-income immigrant families in California. A grandmother in San Francisco asked a clinic to purge all of her grandkids' medical records. A teenage mom canceled WIC just before giving birth. A parent stopped seeking help for their toddler with autism.
The family then just one day called up and said, "We want to stop the process. We don't want to go further.
Paige Tomlin is with First Five, an agency in California that helps families with small children.
And one of the reasons that they gave was They're concerned about their family's immigration status.
In the 1990s, when the federal government blocked many immigrants from public benefits, one quarter of children with an immigrant parent disenrolled from Medicaid, even though most of the kids were still eligible. People who work with kids worry this could happen again, and that would mean hundreds of thousands of kids could be affected. At a school health clinic in Oakland, young students stop in for appointments with nurses and doctors, and also for oatmeal.
Hi, sweetheart. Can I help you?
Your stomach hurts.
Yeah. And let me see your test. And what do you think that's going on? Did you have breakfast this morning?
No.
You didn't have breakfast this morning?
No. Do you want an oatmeal?
So, for example, if someone's not eating breakfast and they're hungry all day, they're not going to be able to study as well. They're not going to succeed as well in school.
Karen Gersten Rothenberg, a family nurse practitioner here, says school-based clinics provide services even if students don't have health insurance. But she's still concerned.
We're able to pick up really early on signs of depression. So I really worry that if families are afraid to seek care for their students, that those kinds of things, which are a lot more silent, will also go undetected and untreated.
Gersten Rothenberg and others are submitting public comments to oppose the government's proposal. The deadline is December 10th. The new rules won't take effect until the government responds to the comments, which could take months. For The World, Zadie Stavely, Oakland, California.
Zadie's story was reported in collaboration with EdSource. Here's a good news refugee story. Hassan Al-Kantar is starting a new life in a new country.
I can relax now.
Kantar is a refugee from Syria who arrived in Canada Monday. You may have heard about him. He spent 7 months stranded inside an airport, kind of like Tom Hanks in the movie The Terminal. Yesterday, Kantar told the CBC program, As It Happens, what his first day of freedom felt like.
To be free, to walk in the roads every morning and to just have some fresh air, it's things I was missing the most. And since yesterday, I did not sleep yet, and I just went outside like 10 times.
You can even hear how lucky Kantar feels. He was sponsored by a Canadian woman, Lori Cooper, who was moved by his story. They met for the first time Monday, and he's staying with Cooper in her home in British Columbia.
And we have our first cup of coffee this morning, and we both can't believe that we finally met and sitting together. So things are still a little bit crazy. I could not sleep. Secretly, I blamed her for that because it was a very warm and comfortable and clean bed. I need to get used to that again because the last 9 months I was sleeping on the floor. So I blame the bed she prepared for me. She's my Canadian mother, and I truly feel that.
Kantar spent 7 months sleeping rough in an airport terminal in Malaysia, then 2 months in a Malaysian detention camp. He shared his experiences in the airport on social media to raise awareness of the plight of refugees. He got quite a following as he shared videos of himself dancing or shaving, even knitting.
I was trying to explain, not to complain, so people will get to understand what's going on really with refugees and with the international law and international system in general and how it failed us. There was a lot of sad moments, but I was trying not to show it.
Kantar is counting his blessings, but his mind is constantly drawn back to others he met in the Malaysian detention camp.
It's hard. And I'm trying just to keep positive, not to think of it too much, because it was not only my story. You will come to know other people, poor people, powerless people from other countries. And you will know that you are not the only person who is suffering. And somehow you will realize that you are lucky. I am lucky to have a group of supporters and volunteers, because my problem will be solved. But their problems and their life will be more difficult.
Hassan Al-Kantar already has a job, and he's looking forward to paying back Canada for welcoming him. A big thanks to the CBC and their program, As It Happens. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Another week, another report ringing alarm bells about climate change. This time, it's the United Nations with their annual report on how countries are doing at cutting their carbon emissions. The verdict? Not good. The World's Carolyn Beeler has this quick update.
We're even farther off course than we thought when it comes to cutting carbon emissions, and time to fix that is running out. That is the bottom line of the UN's annual Emissions Gap report. It was released this week and found that carbon emissions hit a record high in 2017. They had been stagnant for the previous 3 years. Looking ahead, scientists say the world has to hit peak carbon emissions by 2020, just a couple of years away, to stand a chance of keeping global warming well below 2 degrees Celsius, or 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Right now, we are on track for almost 6 degrees Fahrenheit of warming by the end of the century. The UN report found that about half of the G20 is not on track to meet the carbon cuts they promised in the Paris Agreement. That includes the U.S., Canada, Australia, and the European Union. This is the third high-profile climate report released this fall, and like the others, it stresses the need for quick action. These findings will likely shape conversations at an important UN climate meeting in Poland starting next week. At that meeting, leaders of vulnerable nations like the Marshall Islands are expected to lobby hard for more ambitious global climate targets.
The World's Carolyn Beeler there on the latest UN climate report. There are not many industrialized democracies that still use the death penalty. One of them is the United States, another is Japan. Here in the U.S., support for capital punishment is waning, but in Japan, the death penalty still has broad support. Now, though, there's a case that's putting that to the test. It involves a man who's believed to have been the world's longest-serving death row prisoner. Here's reporter Abigail Leonard.
Every day, in any weather, 82-year-old Iwao Hakamada walks for 5 or 6 hours around the small city of Hamamatsu. A volunteer follows a few steps behind, watching as he shuffles along. She's here to make sure he doesn't get hurt and can find his way home.
I know he's innocent. I don't believe it. I know it.
That's his sister, Hideko. He lives with her now. She's 85 and has spent most of her life fighting for him. As a young man, Hakamada was a fighter too, a professional boxer who later worked at a miso factory. In 1966, when Hakamada was 30, the factory manager and his wife and 2 children were stabbed to death in their home. Hakamada was the only suspect. Police interrogated Hakamada for up to 14 hours a day. Hakamada said they beat him with sticks.
It's striking. It's almost stunning how long the interrogations went before finally on day 20, Hakamada confessed.
David Johnson is a sociologist, an expert on the Japanese justice system, at the University of Hawaii, where I reached him by phone. He says false confessions are a major source of wrongful convictions in Japan. Hakamada retracted his confession in court, but the court threw out all of his sworn statements, except the one where he confessed at length.
It's a little bit ironic that a court can find that 43 statements are unreliable and involuntary, but the 44th one is both reliable and voluntary.
Hakamada was convicted and imprisoned for 48 years, 30 of them in solitary confinement. Every morning, Hakamada would wake up at 7 to find out if that would be the day he would die by hanging. Japan doesn't give prisoners advance warning of their executions.
Typically, it's just an hour or two before the hanging occurs that the inmate is told that their time has come.
Back at Hakamada's house, his sister shows me letters he's sent over the years. The earliest ones are from the 1960s. All right, so this one says, the report about the first trial showed evidence was faked and the court misinterpreted the facts. So I truly believe there will be a retrial and I'll be cleared. I'm doing okay, so don't worry. And that's how he concludes all these letters. But in 1980, after 12 years of appeals, the Supreme Court upheld his death sentence. Hideko says that was a turning point for her brother.
A little after that, he told me that the man in the cell next to his had been taken away. And on the way out, he said, "So long, hope you stay well," then never came back. And that was when the death penalty became real to him, and it was very scary.
His letters from that time show his mind starting to unravel. He wrote about things like devils tormenting him in the shower.
I could tell he was getting seriously mentally ill, so I visited every month. But sometimes he refused to see me. I kept going, though, to tell him his family hadn't abandoned him.
Then, nearly 50 years after he was first imprisoned, Hakamada's sister filed for a retrial based on new DNA evidence. His lawyers say Hakamada's blood did not match blood from the crime scene. In 2014, a district court granted the retrial, writing it was possible that key evidence had been fabricated by investigators, and that it was unjust to detain him because of the clear possibility he was innocent. Hakamada was released to his sister.
I remember that day so clearly. I was smiling from the bottom of my heart. It was like I became myself again.
But this is not the end of the story, because in Japan, prosecutors can appeal. This past June, the Tokyo High Court overturned the decision that set Hakamada free. The case now goes to the Supreme Court. If Hakamada loses his appeal, he could be re-imprisoned and, ultimately, executed.
It was a shock. Really, it was a shock.
That's Kiyomi Tsunagai, Hakamada's lawyer. She says returning someone to death row would be unprecedented in Japan, if not the world.
They don't want to admit that they fabricated the evidence and they made mistake in 50 years ago.
Still, there have been concerns raised about how the DNA evidence was handled. But in the end, the court has allowed Hakamada to remain free on bail at his sister's house. A group has come together to support the Hakamadas. One member cooks them lunch every day, and she makes sure someone follows Hakamada on his walks. He doesn't seem to fully grasp his situation, but before he went out, he told me himself how he was feeling.
I feel good. I'm healthy. The world is developing and becoming a good world. The companies tell you, you can make a lot of money and the authorities don't punish you anymore.
A lot of what Hakamada says is pretty hard to understand. But his sister says it makes more sense if you know what his time in prison was like. The guards were so harsh, she says, that even now he's still uncomfortable around men.
Even death row inmates, they're not animals. They're still human and they should be treated with humanity. So I do think Japan should get rid of the death penalty. As for my brother, of course I'd like the Supreme Court to say he's innocent.
But she says if he gets to stay out of prison, maybe that's enough. For The World, Abigail Leonard, Tokyo.
I'm Marco Werman. For years, the civil war in Colombia kept tourists away, even though the government still ran ads like this one.
Colombia.
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 Colombia. The only risk is wanting to stay.
Now that the war is over, some former FARC rebels are becoming tour guides. Our story from Colombia, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Memory and history. If you don't know, you can't remember. If you ignore history, you won't remember. Think about the Holocaust. Now we're hearing that reports of anti-Semitism on the rise in Europe. Still, the Holocaust has also prompted soul-searching, even apologies and restitution. That's what a Dutch railway company is doing. The Nederlandse Spoorwegen carried hundreds of thousands of Jews to concentration camps across Europe in World War II and got paid by the Nazis to do it. 13 years ago, the company made a public apology for its involvement, and today it announced that it will pay compensation to survivors of the Holocaust and their relatives. Ruben Wies heads up NIC, the Dutch affiliate of the World Jewish Congress. I asked him how the move by the Netherlands Railway Company started.
It has been a personal initiative by one survivor, a Jewish survivor, Mr. Salo Müller, whose parents, he was a child at that time, were sent to the death camps, and he survived in hiding. And after so many years of thinking about this and contemplating about this issue, he approached the Dutch railway company and said, it's not fair that my parents had to pay for the deportation and his parents were killed. And he said, I deserve a compensation. And the Dutch railway company came to agreement with him that he deserves a compensation, and so do others.
So the former executive director of the railway company apologized for the role the company played in the Nazi death camps, sending Jews from the Netherlands to the death camps. That apology came in 2005, and you actually played a role in that. Can you tell us more about that apology, how it came about?
What we did as an organization, we approached the Dutch railway company and asked them that it should be good that people would become aware of the fact that as they are traveling today or at that time, 2005, but again, it doesn't make any difference if it's today or some 10 or 15 years ago. They are traveling as everybody does, commuting from home to work or to school or any kind of recreation or whatever, and not realizing that there was a time that these trains or trains in general were used to deport and to separate the Jews and to report them to their final destination, to the death camps. And we approached them. And at first, it was quite difficult to convince them.
Why did they resist at first?
They didn't want to feel to be pointed at as today's railway company on what happened during the Holocaust era. And they said, no, we don't do that. We don't want it. And finally, we convinced them that they have a moral obligation to do so, to stand up and to face up to reality and to their role in the war years. And in the end, we succeeded. And they made this poster campaign possible. And it was shown on many of the largest railway stations in the country.
So you got your apology in 2005. Now we're talking compensation, which is a completely different issue. I gather the actual monetary remuneration is now being discussed. How will that number be calculated?
To be honest, I've got no idea yet. But I tell you something very particular. I just spoke today to my father, who is a Holocaust survivor himself, in hiding at that time. And he said, it's not a matter of money. He said, maybe we can get 10 euros, which is approximately equivalent of $10. The money is not the issue. It's the recognition of the fact that they deported us and we paid for it. That is the issue. So the money, how much, who gets, is question B, C, D, or E. And question A is the recognition by the Dutch Railway Company, for which Salo Müller, Mr. Müller, deserves many, many credits, that it took the money of the people they were sent to the camps.
How important to the Jewish community in the Netherlands would compensation be?
Quite important. Quite important, because as you have to understand, the Dutch Railway Company is a Dutch railway company. It's not the Germans. It's not the Nazis.
Right.
So here you see a lesson which is quite important, what is neglected many times. It were the Dutch who rounded us up. That's what the Holocaust survivors say. It were the Dutch who were involved. It's the Dutch police. It's a Dutch railway company. And for some reason, they didn't manage to get themselves out of the, and I say it politically correct, which obviously wasn't at that time, to stay out of the fire, to stay out of the heat. They played a role. They played a role in rounding up the Jews. And unfortunately, in the end, cost the lives of 75% of the Jewish population in the Netherlands.
So for you, does the news about forthcoming compensation from the Dutch Railway Company, does that give you any hope?
Yes, it does. It definitely does, because it faces up to what it did in the Holocaust years. And it's late, but it does. And I think that's good.
Ruben Vest, the CEO of NEC, that's the World Jewish Congress affiliate in the Netherlands. Really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Did or did not Paul Manafort meet with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London? The Guardian newspaper says Manafort, President Trump's former campaign manager, did meet with Assange three times. Manafort denies it, but we may not have heard the end of the story, nor the end of the story of Assange himself. Assange has been the guest of the Ecuadorian embassy in London for 6 years now. He's thought to be facing charges here in the U.S. and the threat of arrest by authorities in the U.K. There are reports that he's long since worn out his welcome in the embassy. So how do people back in Ecuador itself feel? That's what I asked Ecuadorian journalist Glenda Ortega earlier today. Generally in Ecuador, what do people think about Julian Assange living 6 years in your embassy in London?
Although Assange is a big problem for Ecuador as a country, because, you know, we spend a lot of time and resources to protect him at our embassy in London. But for low class, there is not a big issue. Even if you ask them in the middle of the street, they don't know who Julian Assange is. All the discussion about Assange is for the middle and well-educated class, for academics, diplomatics, and politics.
Yeah, I suppose that's somewhat understandable. What are the middle classes and kind of the country's elite saying about Julian Assange?
Well, they're very indignant for all the millions that the last government and the current government has spent for protecting him.
So Rafael Correa, former president, he left office last year. What is the position of the current Ecuadorian government regarding Assange?
One of the things that that was very, very commented on media and social media and the middle class was all the expenses for the Ecuadorian government. You know, we spent like $5 million to protect Julian Assange, security and all the expenses around him. And I think Lenin Moreno is trying to make a difference between him and the last president, Rafael Correa. He announced that Assange will have to pay his expenses for internet use and laundry facilities and all the things that he is using in the embassy.
I mean, we should remember that Assange holed up at the embassy, the Ecuadorian embassy in London, because extradition worries to the U.S. by the British government. Is the Ecuadorian government cooperating with either the U.K. or the U.S. right now? I mean, do they even care about a possible extradition?
The foreign minister has been told that there's no hostility in the relationship between England and Ecuador. But I think he's very cautious to say something like they are cooperating or they're in a cooperation in this topic.
Glenda Ortega, a journalist currently based in Guayaquil, Ecuador. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
The civil war in Colombia lasted more than 50 years, over half a century. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed. Millions were displaced. So it's no surprise that during the peak of the conflict, visitors stayed away from Colombia, even though the government tried hard to encourage tourism, like with this ad.
Colombia.
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 Colombia. The only risk is wanting to stay.
Since a peace deal between the government and FARC rebels in 2016, tourists have been coming back to Colombia. But it's not just the government that wants tourists. Some former FARC fighters are hoping to now make a living in the tourism trade. Veronica Zaragovia went to their remote camp in Colombia's northeast, near the border with Venezuela. The civil war in Colombia lasted more than 50 years, over half a century. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed. Millions were displaced. So it's no surprise that during the peak of the conflict, visitors stayed away from Colombia, even though the government tried hard to encourage tourism, like with this ad.
Colombia.
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 Colombia. The only risk is wanting to stay.
Since a peace deal between the government and FARC rebels in 2016, tourists have been coming back to Colombia. But it's not just the government that wants tourists. Some former FARC fighters are hoping to now make a living in the tourism trade. Veronica Zaragovia went to their remote camp in Colombia's northeast, near the border with Venezuela.
To get to the camp, we pay a local tour guide to drive us 3 hours inland from the northern beach city of Riohacha. The driver asks a man near the road if we're on the right path. It turns out we're just about there. Soon, we see something the FARC would never have displayed before. A welcome sign in big red letters. Bienvenidos. We get out of the car and see rows of tiny one-room houses made from prefabricated panels. It's sweltering and there's no AC. An ex-fighter named Francisco Villa, who still goes by his FARC name Milo, takes us around the camp. Milo shows us the replica they've set up of guerrilla life before the peace treaty. A hut where fighters and their commanders met at night, a roll-up mattress beneath a camouflage canopy, and a simple clay stovetop. Milo tells us the FARC borrowed the idea from the North Vietnamese, who used a similar stove when hiding in the jungle from the U.S. military. They'd place food over the clay top and tuck firewood underneath. The smoke would exit small holes on the sides, so it wouldn't be detected by surveillance planes. Milo, who's 65, spent three decades as a FARC guerrilla. Now he's a tour guide. We're just starting out, he says. I think hosting people here will eventually be a way forward. While Milo and the others show us artifacts of their life before the peace deal, what they really want us to see are their farms and the textile shop they're operating now. Dios en el Criado sewed thousands of olive green FARC uniforms during the war. Now he helps ex-combatants learn to make clothing for sale using donated machines. The former fighters get a stipend of about $200 a month as part of the peace deal. But Criado says that won't last much longer.
Hemos pensado, bueno, y cuando se acabe eso, nosotros necesitamos un sueldo, necesitamos de qué vivir.
We've thought, well, what happens when all this ends? We need an income. So I started pushing to set up this textile shop, he says. They're sewing shirts and tracksuits, but they don't have many customers yet, just some insurgent-turned-farmers. Another ex-combatant, Elisa Castro, takes us to see their memory museum. She says the people here want to tell their own stories of why they took up arms and what it was like for them living that life.
Una cobija, un toldo, un tendido para tender en el suelo.
She shows us some of the things she used to carry in her backpack, a blanket, a tent. She says sometimes they'd carry small bombs along with underwear, soap, and cologne. It wasn't an easy life, she says, but there were some good moments. Castro tells us about one New Year's Eve when the Colombian army was close by. FARC couples plugged their headphones into portable radios so they could dance together silently without getting caught. Some dance to merengue, she says, others to salsa or reggaeton. Castro's 57 now and studying to get her high school diploma. Castro also cooks sausages and fries on weekends and sells them to other former fighters. But making a living here is tough. They've hosted some tourists from Denmark and Japan, all by word of mouth. They don't have a website or a social media campaign. And getting Colombians to come visit wouldn't be easy. Feelings about the FARC are still raw. For years, the FARC terrorized the country through bombings, kidnappings, and murders. When the peace treaty was put to a vote in 2016, a slim majority rejected it. They thought the deal went too easy on the FARC. It seems surreal to meet these former combatants who seem so friendly and welcoming, and think about how they may have caused so much pain during the war. But they all tell me they're committed to living in peace. They just need to figure out how to support themselves and live as civilians. For the world, Veronica Saragovia, Pondores, Colombia.
Veronica's story was supported by the Pulitzer Center. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Heads are spinning around the world this week after a Chinese scientist claimed that he helped create the world's first genetically edited babies. If the claim is true, Hua Jianque essentially messed around with the embryonic genes of twin girls who were then born this month. Hua has not published his research methods or results or gotten peer review for his work, so it's all hard to verify. But he believes he's made an important breakthrough, proving that you can alter embryonic genes to prevent transmission of HIV. Bioethicists, though, have been shaken to the core by the claim. Alex Perlman is a bioethicist and journalist who works at the intersection of human rights and emerging technologies. Let's start with the basics here, Alex, and I don't know if there is a simple way to explain what gene editing actually is, but what exactly did Hua Jianque do, or more precisely, what did he claim he did?
The best way to explain it might be to say that it's something like a molecular pair of scissors, where CRISPR-Cas9 is a technology that includes a protein that can cut DNA at certain places in the genome and remove certain strands or genes. And then what happens next is, you know, unclear, essentially, when you do it in humans. And that is part of the controversy around what Dr. Hui is claiming.
Today at a genome summit in Hong Kong, he actually said he was proud of altering the genes of the twin girls so they could not contract HIV. Couldn't you argue that what he claims to have done is a good thing?
I don't think you can. I don't think that there is any part of what he's done that could be considered a good thing. There are so many levels to this, but when he's claiming to have made these girls immune to HIV, first of all, just a claim, not proven, not reviewed anywhere, But we also don't know what else he could have done. So even if that were true, we don't know what other ramifications or back doors he has left open in these girls' genomes. Not to mention, he has upended a number of ethical and scientific norms and has violated the trust of scientists and ethicists around the world who have said for years now that the science is just not precise enough. We just don't know what it can do, and we're not ready to use it in humans. And there has been sort of a wide agreement on that.
The ethical issues that have come up for scientists and really bothered them around the world, what are the top ethical issues for you?
The top one really is that this is changing the human germline, which means that when a similar genome edit is done in a grown adult person on their cells, it's not possible for them to pass it along. So the bigger question is whether the changes that are made in these babies will be then inherited by their offspring and essentially passed on for humans forever. There's no taking it back once Wow. you've put it out there. So that's a really big step to take without wide agreement that we're ready to do that, to fundamentally change the building blocks of humanity. There's also a concern that this technology, because it's so controversial, but because it's also comparatively easy, that other scientists are going to look at this as essentially permission. Other rogue scientists are going to try to do the same thing for a pretty penny.
You wrote for The World online recently, Alex, that we're already halfway down that slippery slope toward designer babies and how in vitro fertilization or IVF babies are created. Explain what you mean by halfway down.
One of the things that I think a lot of people are concerned about when the term designer babies comes out is the idea of selecting for certain traits. And what I see is that we already select for certain traits. Technology has advanced so that we can select embryos based on their sex, based on disease traits. We have this technology and we use it, and it's legal in the United States and in many other places. But what we're talking about in China, if it's true, is essentially way past where we can be ethically. But we're not progressing that way. And embryo research, I believe, should go forward in a safe and regulated way so that people who want to have healthy babies can use the technology that's available.
And as to that point, if this story is true, what should happen next in order to verify that what Hui says he's done, he's actually done?
He should be publishing in a scientific journal. That should automatically be his next step. He should have done that originally. And the fact that he didn't submit his data for peer review is frankly astounding to a lot of people. I think that the next phase of this is for people to look at it, analyze it, for experts to consider all of his data, including his history of experimentation on embryos in mice and monkeys, which he said that he did. As far as a regulatory road forward, I fear that the backlash of this will unfortunately create a political firestorm that will set safe embryo editing and safe experimentation back, and that this will create a really sticky regulatory problem for those scientists that are behaving responsibly. And I hope that that's not the case.
Bioethicist and journalist Alex Perlman, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Marco, for having me.
Are you ready, kids?
Aye, aye, Captain!
I can't hear you!
Aye, aye, Captain!
Oh! Who lives in a pineapple under the sea?
If you don't recognize this, you've probably been living under the sea, although maybe not under a pineapple. SpongeBob SquarePants, his creator Steven Hillenburg, died yesterday, age 57. He suffered from ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. The talking and singing sponge he created became popular just about everywhere.
Siete pronti, ragazzi?
Sì, signore, signor capitano!
Non riesco a sentirvi!
Sì, signore, signor capitano!
Alles klar, Kinder! Geht das nicht lauter?
Aye, aye, Captain!
Oh. 准备好了吗，孩子们？
是的，班长。
太小声喽！
是的，班长。
Oh.
SpongeBob a-go-go in Italian, German, and Mandarin there. The series traveled to over 200 countries. Now, I don't want to overload you with SpongeBob, but you've got to hear this version from New Zealand. It debuted during Maori Language Week in 2009 to promote the indigenous language to kids. SpongeBob SquarePants theme like you've never heard it, in memory of his creator, the late Stephen Hillenburg, a wildly creative mind who made a lot of people happy. That's the world for this Wednesday. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. We're back tomorrow.
Absorbent and yellow and porous is he.
SpongeBob SquarePants!
If nautical nonsense be something you wish.
SpongeBob SquarePants!
Then drop on the deck and flop like a fish.
PRI, Public Radio International.